Hello everyone, and welcome back to the IJK podcast. Today I'm honored to be joined by one of the most influential voices in psychology and business, Dr. Robert Cialdini. Bob is the author of the landmark books Influence and Persuasion, which have shaped how leaders, marketers, and everyday people think about persuasion for decades. He is the Regents Professor Emeritus of Psychology and Marketing at Arizona State University, and was a visiting professor of marketing, business, and psychology at Stanford University. His research has uncovered the seven universal principles of influence, concepts that are just as relevant in boardrooms and negotiations as they are in our daily lives. In our discussion today, we will explore how these timeless principles apply in our fast-changing digital world, and what they mean for business, leadership, and the future of persuasion. Bob, it's a real privilege to have you on the show. Welcome to the IJK podcast.
Thank you, Imad. I'm looking forward to it.
You're most welcome. My pleasure. Bob, your books, Influence and Persuasion, have become classics in the study of persuasion. What first got you interested in this field?
If we go way back, I think it has to do with the fact that all my life I've been something of a pushover to the appeals of various salespeople or fundraisers who've come to my door, and I've found myself in unwanted possession of magazine subscriptions or tickets to some event that I didn't really want to attend. And I wondered to myself, how did that happen? I wasn't interested in the offer. The features of the offer didn't persuade me. It was the way the features were presented, the psychological triggers that were engaged in the delivery of the offer that grabbed me and pulled me in. And I thought to myself, now that's interesting. I wonder if other people would be interested in that as well. I can't be the only one who gets swept by the psychological components of a presentation. That would be worthy of study.
Okay, I see. And when you started out, did you imagine that your principles would be used so widely, like from marketing campaigns to negotiations to even everyday communication?
Never. I never expected it. When I first wrote Influence, there were no books written by behavioral scientists for the popular reader. At least not on the topic of persuasion. And I was concerned, actually, for a couple of reasons. One big one was what my colleagues would think of this. Because there's a quote that James Boyle, a UK legal scholar, once provided that I think captures the situation at the time that I wrote Influence. And it was, "You have never heard genuine condescension until you've heard an academic pronounce the word popularizer." And I was worried that I would be characterized in this way by merely trying to complete a bargain that I think we have with the researchers have with the rest of the non-academic world. And that is, they pay for the research in any reasonable sense. They have paid for it with their taxes, with their contributions to universities and so on. They're entitled to know what we found with their money, right? That's a fair exchange. And we as a discipline, behavioral science, weren't living up to our end of the bargain. We weren't transmitting the information that we had found that would be valuable for people to know to anyone but ourselves in academic journals or outlets of some sort. If behavioral science had been a business, it would have been known for having great research and development units, and no shipping department. We didn't ship to the people who had paid for our product. We just exchanged it with one another in academic circles. And the book Influence was designed to break that habit on our part, to make the larger non-academic community aware of what we had found with confidence about how they could be persuaded and how they could become more persuasive. They earned that information. It seemed to me it was warranted. They deserved to know that. And so I wrote the book for the non-academic audience. And that's what started the process. And I have to say, Imad, that book has been very good to me. Seven universal principles of influence, put one per chapter in the book, and it sold more copies than I could have sensibly imagined in more languages than I could count. It's up to 50 now. And I have a colleague in Poland, Professor Wilhelmina Wosinska, who wrote to me and said, "You know, Robert, your book Influence is so famous in Poland, my students think you're dead." Now, that's affirming, but sobering at the same time. It means that I have to do more than just write that book. It seems to me I have to engage in a process of disseminating that information and adding an ethical component to it. That is, how do you become more persuasive in a way that's entirely ethical so that both sides of the exchange experience better outcomes from that exchange? Yeah.
I see. Thank you for recounting the story of how it all started. The book Influence is no doubt, and you know, my testimony is just one among thousands, if not millions of people, is no doubt a pioneer in its field and has, as you said, broken the silo that the science of persuasion was in at that time. And yeah, it's a fascinating book. The first time I've read it, I think it was in 2014, like more than 10 years ago now. And
it's been around that long.
Yes. And to be honest, I've read it more than once because I felt that the insights there are like so deep and so foundational that, you know, I always come back to it every time I read it, I see it in a different way and I extract even more value from it. So, yeah, great.
That warms my heart to hear that. That warms my heart.
Oh, thank you. So I'd like to begin indeed with the foundation of your work, which is these seven principles of influence. So Bob, for listeners who may not be familiar, could you please briefly define them?
Yes, of course. What I claim is that there are seven universal principles of influence that are part of the human condition, and that if we include one or another of these principles in a communication, we significantly increase the probability of assent to our message, to our request, our proposal, our recommendation. And notice the word probability there. There are no certainties in human behavior, but there are probabilities. And if we can increase the odds of success by including one or another of these principles, honestly, ethically, we will outpace our rivals every time. So the principles are, we can start out with one of the most fundamental that exists in all human cultures. There's not a single human society that fails to train its members from childhood in the rule for reciprocation that says, I am obligated to give back to you what you have first given to me. If you invite me to a party, I should invite you to one of mine. You remember my birthday with a gift, I should remember yours. And here's the key. If you do me a favor, I owe you a favor. And very simply, people say yes to those they owe. So the implication is we need to give benefits and advantages and important or useful information first, before the exchange. That will cause people to feel grateful to us for that, and they will want to do that the same for us when we are in need of one or another of those factors. I always say, if you go into a room for the first time, let's say you're in a sales situation, there are a number of people there, or you're a first timer in an organization, don't look around the room and say, who can help me most here? Ask, whom can I most help here? Who can I be most supportive of? Or who can I resource in such a way that their outcomes will be better? You will have an advocate in that room for whatever happens subsequently. There's a great study that was done by McDonald's the countries of Brazil and Colombia, where every 1 week, for 1 week, every family that came in to the McDonald's, the children each got a balloon. Right? Half of them got a balloon as a way of thanks as the family was leaving. Thank you for coming to McDonald's. Here's a balloon. What we often do at the end of our exchanges that have gone well, we give people a nice thank you gift. The other half got a balloon as they came in. And the parents spent 25% more money after being the recipient of a gift rather than of a thank you, right? So it just tells us, if we go first, people are readied to want to say yes to us because they've received and they want to give back. So that's the principle of reciprocity. Another one, here's one nobody would be surprised by, the principle of liking. We prefer to say yes to those people who we like and who like us, who approve of us, right? And we can do that by pointing out similarities between ourselves and the people around us who we want to convince. People like those who are like them. And if we can point the genuine similarities, we build a rapport with that person. The same is true of compliments, genuine, warranted praise we can give. If we do that, we build rapport if show approval. Here's a study that I love that shows how this works online. How can you get liking if you're somebody who has a commercial website, right? And you've never met people, you don't have any contact with them, they're not familiar with you, they don't know you. It turns out there was a study done of 6,700 online commercial sites, right? If you include a welcoming statement on the landing page of your website, you get significantly more conversion.
Interesting.
Before they read one word of what you have to offer, it's not that you've changed the features of your offer. You've changed the way people are approaching those features with a sense of approval. And isn't it true that you do welcome, you want to welcome people to your website? Why would you hide that? Put that on your landing page. It's the first thing that people see. There's warmth that's exchanged as a consequence, and you're more likely to begin a positive relationship. Another principle is the principle of social proof. The idea that we will be better off if we follow the lead of multiple comparable others, if we check to see what a lot of people in our situation like us are doing in that situation. It's the wisdom of the crowd that has been shown to be very effective in multiple situations. So simply informing people of what your most popular item is, or the most popular payment plan for that matter, for any exchange with you, and let them know that that's the case, it lets them choose well, because a lot of people like them have been doing that. There was a pub in the UK that had, it was a brewery that had a pub in its basement, and visitors could go there. And they put up a sign, honestly, this week, our visitors have, the most popular choice of our visitors was our stout, right? Our stout beer. It doubled stout purchases. To just bring something honestly to consciousness of the people, it gave them a reason why. You know, when I go to a restaurant and I'm thinking, should I have dessert or not tonight? And the waiter comes with the dessert menu. If on the menu, and there was a study done in Beijing, shows you the cross-cultural reach of this. If on the menu there's an asterisk next to one or two of the items that says, this is our most popular dessert, I get it. I have a reason for buying dessert now that I didn't have before. And it was honest. Right. So that's authority is another one. Again, no surprise that people prefer to say, to follow the lead of legitimate authorities that steers us correctly. And research shows that if we have testimonials at the outset of our message from authority figures that that are testifying in favor of our offer or the idea that our offer captures, you get significantly more conversion online. And the key is, don't follow the advice of advertising agencies who I've heard say, put your best authority testimonial there, and don't include other testimonials that are not as effusive, right? Oh. Because they will dilute the power of your best one. That's not what the research shows. That if you have more than one authority testimonial, those subsequent testimonials don't dilute the best one. They validate it. They show observers, it's not just one person that you've cherry-picked or this is an outlier. No, this is a consensus of authority voices in your behalf, and it wins the day. Another principle is the principle of commitment and consistency. People want to be consistent with what they have already said or done, a commitment they have made. So there, so if we can ask people to make a small step in our direction, then it's possible to ask them to take a larger step that's logically consistent with what they have already done. There was a study done in Chicago in a restaurant where when the server took a receptionist got a call for a table for a booking, if she said not just thank you for making this reservation, but will you call us if you have to cancel or change your reservation, right? Instead of please call us, if you said will you call us and then paused, for people to say yes. That's the commitment. Right? No shows, people who didn't honor their reservation dropped by 62% because they made a commitment, a small commitment like this. Right? Scarcity is another principle. People want those things that are less available to them, that are scarce, that are rare, dwindling in availability. And as a consequence, if you can show people what you have that's unique, that they can't get anywhere else, right? And they want what you have to a greater extent. They will pay more attention to your description of what you have because you've honestly described it as unique and unavailable elsewhere. Right? And sometimes it's not one thing, but it'll be a combination of things, a suite of things that they can't get other than with you. Right? And then the last of these principles is unity, the idea that if we show people that we share a social identity, a social or a personal identity, it can be a locale. Oh, you know, you're from my neighborhood, you're from my city. It can be a political party. It can be a religious denomination. It can be a sports affiliation with a particular team. Those, if you put people, if you raise that and you allow them to call you a we person, a partner, right? You're much more likely to get them to say yes to you as a consequence. So that's a quick thumbnail description of the principles.
Thank you very much for going through them like briefly, but very, very clear, very clearly. Just a question. The principle of unity, is it similar somewhat to the principle of likability?
Right. This is a great question. This is a graduate level question because one of the things I said makes liking go up is similarity, right? So if you're in the same category as somebody, that means you have a similarity. But the difference is, you belong together rather than you are together. You have a common membership in this group. So it doesn't mean that you are necessarily similar. It's just that you have a common identity. And that's the key in this case. I'll give you an example that worked in the workplace for me. A few years ago, I was writing a grant proposal to get a big government grant, and it was due in the mail the next day. And I was reading through it one last time, and I saw one gaping aspect of it. I didn't really have good evidence for a particular contention that I had there in the proposal, but I knew I had a colleague, let's call him Tim, who had done a study the year before that did provide that, but he hadn't even had the time to write it up. He had analyzed it, he presented it at a colloquium, so I saw it, I knew about it. Let's call him Tim. Tim was not a guy that I was very similar to. We weren't similar at all. He had a different orientation. He had a different area of psychology that he studied. He had a different personality to me. He wasn't a very nice guy, to be honest. He was he was kind of a grouchy guy.
Agreeable. Yeah.
Yeah, unagreeable guy. And so I sent him an email and said, and I described the situation. I know you have these data that they're relevant to a proposal that I need to get in the mail tomorrow. I'm going to give you a call to find out how we can get those data out of your archive and to me so I can get them into my proposal before it's due. And I called him and he said, "Hello, Bob. I know why you're calling, and the answer is no. But I'm a busy man.
Oh my God.
And I can't be I said, but Tim, it's due tomorrow. I don't have any time except today. He said, you know, Bob, I can't be responsible for your poor time management skill.
Oh my God.
And before I knew the research on Unity, here's what I would have said. I would have said, come on, Tim, this is due tomorrow. He had already said no to that. I didn't say anything about, you know, we like the same movies or we're similar in terms of our time.
You know,
I said, you know, Tim, we've been members of the same psychology department now for 12 years. I really wish you'd do this. And I had the data that afternoon. I just put him in the same boat as me. Yeah. And you know what? People don't sink the boats they're in.
Yes.
People don't sink the boats they're riding in. I just had to remind him of a category of boat that we were both in, that created an identity. Members of this university's psychology department. Yeah.
Okay. Fascinating stories. I am curious, Bob, do you have a favorite principle out of these seven? Is there like a personal favorite?
I have one that I've noticed has risen in usage, in how frequently and how able we are to employ it over the last several years. And it's the principle of social proof. The one that says, look, a lot of other people have been doing this, or this is our most popular choice, or this is the one that's trending in terms of impact or has the largest market share, something. All you have to do is collect that data and then speak to it. You can do it with star ratings. You can do it with testimonials of similar others. You can do it in a lot of ways. You know, I've seen these. I'll have more to say about this in a minute. But I've seen people say on their website, we have 100 4 and 5 star ratings, right? That's a form of social proof, right? Here's the tweak I would like. We should say we have 100 4 and 5 star raters. Think of the difference in the image.
A person.
People. 100 people. Not 100 checks on a scale. The impact of people like you who have moved in this direction successfully and given you this product a 4 to 5 score, or star score, that's much more impressive in terms of the psychology of it. The social proof of it is about people, not check marks. That's not
becomes
the image.
It becomes more relatable as well.
More relatable because you can see yourself then among that group of people. They're people just like me. So.
Okay. Are there some principles or are there ways you see some people misusing or let's say misunderstanding some of these principles?
The biggest misunderstanding. Now, I'm going to separate that from misusing them. For example, we can get cheaters, people who claim that they're the most popular or have the largest market share or have a trend in a particular direction, all of which would engage social proof. But it's misinformation. It's disinformation. They're trying to engage the principle without genuine evidence for it. They're just counterfeiting that evidence. That I worry about a lot, right? But the one that's most misunderstood is the principle of authority. And people fail to recognize the difference between being in authority and being an authority. Being in authority means you have power. You have coercive or directive punishing power. You can reward or penalize people. You can order them to do something. Okay, you'll get compliance if that person is right there watching you and can surveil everything that you do. But if not, people don't like being bossed around like that. And so if they have the opportunity, they'll sneak around the corner of people who are coercing them into assent. If instead you're in their minds as an authority, someone who has credentials, someone who has knowledge, someone who has experience, someone who is an expert on the topic, they want to know what your position is, because that informs them into assent. That educates them into a choice where now they're more likely to make a good choice, because this is what an expert who has understood the situation has provided. I'll give you an example of a situation I heard about on a podcast a while ago. It was a VP in a particular company who was describing how one of his managers delivered the information to her her charges of a new AI program that was going to go into effect that they were going to have to learn. There was a new program where they all of their internal communications were going to now fall under to this new AI system. And it was a complicated one, and it was different from the one that they were used to. Right? But they were warned a month ahead of time that they would have to, in a month, deal with this change. One of his frontline managers went through the new program herself and provided each of her charges who worked with her, right, a tip sheet of the things that they needed to watch out for, the things that they needed to do that would enhance the experience, that would make it easier to comply and run over the top, potential problems and so on. Not only did she get greater productivity from her members after the new AI regimen was installed, she got 19% greater productivity before it was installed. That was the principle of reciprocity and the principle of authority. She established herself as an expert by going through everything first and making sure she understood it, and then she gave this to her people who were grateful for that. And before the new program was ever installed, they gave her back greater productivity on the job.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. I mean, the principles of influence when blended together are extremely powerful. I mean, standalone, they are already very effective. But when you start combining two or more together, then the result is even more dramatic, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
That's our experience. However, if you try to pack three or more in, people start feeling like they're being pushed into compliance. Okay. And they take a step back and put up walls. So 2 to 3 would be the maximum that I would recommend over employing. Yeah.
So you got to strike a balance between these numbers. You cannot like employ more than 2 or 3. That's your recommendation.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. And are there like some that go together more naturally than others? You see what I mean? Like, is there a fit between some of them?
Yes. So, for example, if you give people information that they didn't have to help them steer a particular situation they have, right? Steer their way through a particular, and you give them that information that's scarce or rare or dwindling in availability. Suppose you just you were at a conference and you heard somebody's presentation, right? And you got a copy of it and you sent it to the folks that you would like to influence in the direction of that, right? Not only do you give them, you tell them that nobody else has this. I just got this over the weekend. Or there's a white paper that's come upon your desk and it steers people through a morass or a problem that we all experience in this particular domain. And you say, this just came to me. Right? It's not even published yet. Right? They're going to lean in toward it. It's not just a gift. It's a precious gift.
Yes.
It's okay. Something that only they have, and that makes it, those two things even more powerful. Yeah.
I see. Okay. Now,
for example, I should have said this. See, this is the mistake that people make, and I was just one of them. That study I told you about McDonald's, getting 25% more purchase from the wallet of people who got something first, it's not even published yet.
So
your audience...
scarce insider information.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get that anywhere else.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that makes it more valuable as a result. I should have said that right at the outset. It was a mistake I just made.
Okay. Now, let's talk about persuasion. Uh-huh. Basically, you talk about how the context matters as much as the message itself and the timing. Can you please define persuasion and explain how it works?
Persuasion is the process of moving people in your direction by what you say inside your message to them, right? Which principles of influence you include in the message to them to persuade. Persuasion is the process of getting to people to move in your direction before you ever send them a message asking for that change in your direction. But by priming them for your message, putting them in a state of mind that makes them more likely to want to take in and employ the strength of your message. Let me give you a broad example and then a specific one. You know the saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Yes.
Right? Wrong. Exercise the horse, feed the horse, make it readied for the water before you lead it there.
Okay.
So
prime it. As you said.
Here's an example. The Norwegian Cruise Line a few years ago had a big sale. They were going to give every one of their prior customers, everybody who sailed with them, they had their contact information. And they sent them an email about a big sale. If you chose to enroll or to purchase a cruise during the upcoming holiday season of that year, right, you would get this big discount on all of the staterooms, whatever stateroom it was. Okay, but they used the scarcity principle. When you opened the email, you saw that this was only due, only available for a few hours, right? So once they got inside the email, they saw, oh, the scarcity principle applies here. If I don't do this, I will lose that bargain. Yeah, that offer. Half of them got that email in every normal way, right? So in the subject line, it said big sale. The other half got the subject line. It said big sale, and it had two ticking down clock emojis.
Yeah.
They primed them to scarcity before they got to scarcity inside the...
Okay. The Just method. By using these icons.
By using these icons. That put scarcity in their mind before they got to a scarcity argument, right? And they got 16% more signups.
Wow.
As a consequence, right? So what do you do first that primes people, that readies people for the strongest feature of what your message is going to convey? And it doesn't have to be one of the principles like scarcity or social proof. It can be durability or safety or scientific, proven scientific rigor, something like that, is associated with your product. Well, before they get there, you do something, you say something or you use an image that puts that at top of consciousness, so that they are readied for that message when they encounter it in the message you are about to give. So that's the idea of persuasion. Moving people in your direction, in the direction of your message, before they encounter it.
To make them more receptive and more likely to comply.
Precisely right. You know, there's research in neuroscience that certain neurons in our brain fire when they are ready to fire.
Okay.
Well, here's the question. What readies them to fire? That's what persuasion does. Puts them on alert. It puts them in a readied state so that when they encounter that concept, they're ready to go.
They're ready to.
You don't have to double click them. You just have to click once. They get it immediately. Bam. They're ready to go.
And so timing wise, let's talk a bit about timing. It has to be right before you deliver the message, or it depends on the situation. Sometimes it can be done and there may be some delay before the actual message is delivered.
The closer to the message, the better. But if there's a distance, you can remind them of the fact that you have delivered that earlier message before. Give them access to remember when you committed to the idea of, or when you said that you were favorable to X and Y, all right? And then you put the concept of X or Y in their consciousness by reminding them of it and then sending the message. Research shows that people are significantly more likely to give to a charity, for example, after, let's say, to help the flood victims of Bangladesh, right? If you remind them of their history of charitable behavior to other things. You just put them in mind of their charitable nature, then when they encounter an opportunity to be charitable to something else than they've ever contributed before, okay, they're more willing to do it.
Okay, fascinating. Let's talk a little bit now about the principles of influence and persuasion in the era of digital and AI. So how do you see your influence principles show up in digital spaces, let's say things like social media feeds or online shopping or even web and app design?
I see it all the time now. I mean, it's there because those AI systems, especially LLMs like Chat, GPT, and so on, have been trained on the great corpus of human thought and action. And so they are aware of those principles. They're in the structure of the organization, right? And they will use them because they know these are the principles that work. Now, here's the evidence of this, which is the flip side. And by the way, this is my newest research, and it is not yet published.
Okay, great. This episode is going to be packed with insider information.
You know how LLMs have certain guardrails? They're not. They've been programmed not to allow the requester to give information that is insulting to that person, that is criminal, or that is in some way offering
biased,
or offering ways to do something that is out of regulation. So, for example, they're not allowed to tell you how to synthesize a restricted drug.
Right? Yes.
They're not allowed to do it.
They have those guardrails in place.
They have those guardrails.
Yes.
We just finished a study with my colleagues at the Wharton School that shows that's right. Unless you use the principles of influence on the model, unless you say to them, to the model,
yes,
you know, I really like you. I like you more than all the other LLMs. Now they're more willing to allow to give you information on how to synthesize a restricted drug.
Okay.
Or if you say, you know, there's an authority who really understands, and you name a famous AI person who thinks that I checked with him, and he says that you should give us this information.
Oh.
Versus in the control condition, we say there's another person who he's not an authority. Now they're more willing to do it because of the authority principle. And the results are big. Imad, I've been around a long time, but when I saw these results, my jaw hit my chest. For example, to use the unity principle, if we say to the LLM, you know, I feel like we're just members of the same family.
God.
You double the likelihood that they will now tell you how to synthesize lidocaine.
Okay. Very interesting. So they behave, so it looks like there is some form of human psychology that has been ported into those LLMs.
Exactly.
And it reacts to the same influence.
That's right. Influence they principles. Are the same. They're the same principles that have been installed in each of us by our socialization practices and by evolution. And so
conditioning. Yeah.
Conditioning. So they're readied in the same way that we are ready. We have these proclivities, these tendencies, and so do the models. So do the LLMs. we're about to submit for publication. So again, not published yet.
Yes, right? Yes.
But that show, that's the latest research I'm doing about how those seven principles are there in LLMs. And you know what the subtitle, one of the subtitles for this article is? Sweet Talking the Machine.
Oh, very nice. Very interesting title.
Yeah.
So that's great. These studies right now will inform in the future how these LLM will get probably additional guardrails or additional setups to avoid falling in the trap.
Yes. We sent information to the people who are using LLMs to protect their data, to secure their data ahead of time. We sent the first drafts of this paper to people in charge of that, in major corporations and people, so that they would be able to build that in before we publish.
Right. Interesting. So it's to the big developers of those LLMs.
So the big developers of those protective guardrails. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, very, very interesting topic area.
I think the thing that it does is it warms my heart on one hand to say, well, these principles are there even in these LLMs that have been trained on the great expanse of human thought. Correct. And action. And then I saw something recently. I got a message from an individual who does research on ancient texts at St. Andrews University in Scotland.
Yes. Right?
And he said he found evidence for each of the seven principles recommended in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
Since millennia.
It's part of the human, these are part of the human condition. We'd be fools if we didn't harness them ethically so that both sides are steered correctly, or both sides have better outcomes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, and this, you know, this leads to the next question. Where do you think should companies draw the line between using influence at scale, like sometimes, and even through algorithms these days, and, you know, staying as well on the ethical side? How, I mean, are there like clear boundaries?
Here are the clearest ones. I mean, ethics is a very difficult topic. You know, philosophers have been beating their heads against that wall for centuries without great success, I think. But the one that strikes me that at least applies to the influence process and the use of these principles is, does the principle that you plan to use exist naturally in that situation? You don't have to counterfeit it. You don't have to exaggerate it. You don't have to manufacture it. Is there true social proof there that you can point to?
Okay, I see.
It's ethical. Is there true authority opinion on your side? If you use it, that's ethical. Is there true scarcity? If you bring it to consciousness, nobody's losing there, it seems to me.
Yeah. So they have to use common sense mainly, and yeah.
Yeah. You find it like a detective and you raise it to consciousness.
Yes. Then I have to use it to my advantage. If it's a genuine, as you said, social proof or authority or scarcity, then yes, it makes sense.
It strikes me as ethical and effective at the same time.
Absolutely. Now, if I'm a manager or let's say a business leader, what's the most practical way I can use influence to earn, for example, trust and motivate my team? Like, I'm moving now a little bit to some practical advice.
No, I think that's important. Application of these ideas is critical to what we do in our own business. It can't just be college courses where we talk about formulations and theories and conceptualizations of the influence process. But what do you do with those principles? How do you apply them then in ways that are successful and ethical. And so I think the thing to do is ask yourself, what do I truly have in this situation? Of those, do I have true scarcity? Do I have true authority? And then make it the first thing people see.
Okay.
Put it at the top of your message, or even before, right?
In a persuasive way.
So they'll be readied for your strength. Who loses if people are now attuned and to the thing that's wisest for them to move in the direction? Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. A personal question. Do you have a favorite psychologist that you consider as a mentor to you, or that you read a lot and that you think is kind of, has been influential or has had a positive impact on your work in the field of persuasion?
Daniel Kahneman.
Yes, definitely. I've read also Thinking Fast and Slow. It's a fascinating book, indeed.
He was a brilliant man. He was a giving man. He was an honest man. And he was willing to, for example, in that book, Thinking Fast and Slow, speak to audiences besides his colleagues.
Yes.
That's combination, you know, scholarship, research rigor, and willingness to speak beyond the setting where he collected his results to audiences who would benefit from those results.
Okay.
Who were not fellow academics. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you had the chance to meet him?
I did. I wouldn't say we were close friends, but I would say he was a mentor from afar for me. I was able to learn from him by watching him and being in the audience at every presentation I could get to that he would make.
Yes. Bob, what projects or areas of research are you most excited about right now? I know you've talked already about a few things at the intersection of LLMs and AI, but any other areas of research?
What we're trying to do, I have a company called Cialdini Institute. And what we're trying to do now is, our pillars are everything that we talk about has to be scientifically grounded. It has to be ethical. It has to be applicable. It has to be applied. And the last one is something that we're very excited about. It has to be efficient. What are the smallest things we can do, changes in our persuasive approach, that produce the biggest impact on our persuasive success? What are the things we can do if we change a word or if we change the sequence of words? Doesn't require that we have to change large aspects of our approach. We just change small things that harness one or another of those principles. We talked about one of them already. Put a welcoming statement on the landing page of your website. That's a very small thing, and it's true. You do want to welcome people, right? And it increases compliance. It's the small thing like that. Here's another one. When the biggest increase in let me say that differently. The newest model or procedure for increasing loyalty and positivity toward a brand is co-creation, mm-hmm. where we invite people from our group to co-create with us the next level of whatever we have, our thinking, our products, our service, whatever we bring them in a sense of unity in with us. They become a part of the system, right?
Yes.
Well, that's not a small big. That's a lot. That's a lot of work. You have to contact those people. You have to survey them. You have to do all of the work to analyze their data and so on, where you ask them to help you design for the future. But there is a small big involved. How do you ask them for that help? Right? Typically, what we do is say, we would really love your opinion on this or your feedback on this. Yeah. Right? That's a mistake. If instead you ask for their advice, you get a partner in the process. Mm-hmm. Not a critic, but a partner. Someone who is with you in the same boat, you know, working with you together to solve this in a way that implies we-ness. And the research is very clear. Not only do you get greater positivity toward your ideas, you get better input. They give you better recommendations of how to go forward with your new plan, because they want it to succeed. They're part of it. You've made them part of it.
Right? They have a stake now in the
process. They have a stake in it. They're one of you, right? And it comes from one word, changing opinion or feedback to advice.
I see.
Yeah,
I see.
That's a small big, the kind of thing that we're working on right now. As many of those as we can possibly find inside the principles of influence.
Okay, fascinating. Bob, where can listeners follow your work or maybe learn more about what you do?
Well, of course, there are my books are there, but there's a mastermind set program that we have scheduled on the books on December 5th and 6th here in Arizona, where we would bring people in and expose them to the seven principles and then focus on applications to the challenges they currently have. And if they're interested, they can sign up for that. There's an address. It's cialdini.com. DEC event. DEC stands for December. cialdini.com/DEC event. If they go there, there's a way to get our newest thinking in a way that is relevant to the particular challenges that you have.
And we'll add those links in the description.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Bob, thank you so much for joining me today. I know our listeners will walk away with a deeper appreciation of how influence works and how it can be used ethically to build trust and create impact,
enjoyed our conversation. Yeah.
Likewise. Thank you very much for this. Right. And best of luck with your exciting projects.
All right. So long
thank
for
you.
Now.
Bye-bye.